and welcome to Comic Boom, the Comics in Education podcast. If you're interested in using comics in the classroom, then this is the podcast for you. My name is Lucy Starbuck-Bradley, and each week I'll be joined by a fellow educator, an academic, a librarian, or a creator of comics to discuss their journey into comics and provide some inspiration to influence your practice. And today we're joined by Shivetta Miller, who is a national literacy leader and serves on the Governor's Council for Educator Advancement in Oregon as a professional learning facilitator. She's over there in America, specialising in the visual arts, a former high school language arts teacher and author of Hacking Graphic Novels, 8 Ways to Teach Higher Level Thinking with Comics and Visual Storytelling. I absolutely love this book. I'm going to talk about it more in a minute and throughout the episode, but I really highly recommend that text. She's a passionate advocate for using multimodal texts of all kinds to create engaged, insightful, curious readers and thinkers who are comfortable with the complex. You'll find all the details for Shivetta's Twitter, for her LinkedIn and so on in the show notes. Definitely connect with her. She is a very experienced and knowledgeable person. Really, really enjoyed talking to her in this episode. Her book, Hacking Graphic Novels, was a real find for me. I felt like it dealt with so many of the things that I've been thinking about in terms of how to really bring to life teaching with graphic novels in the classroom as part of the curriculum, making that step from the reading for pleasure space into the study and the kind of academic rigour and the excitement that you can get from really, really thinking deeply about comics and graphic novels with a class. And that book just has so many practical tips and advice. It is written in the American educational context, so if you are not listening from America, you will have to do a little bit of translation in your mind, but it's all very, very relevant. And there are examples right from the early years through to secondary education. As Shivetta's bio says, she is a secondary practitioner by training, so a lot of what we talk about in the first part of the episode is relevant to older students, but I think there's definite read across to anyone who's listening who might work with younger children. And then later on in the episode we do loop back to and talk about some her learnings and experiences from creating the book around how to use these ideas and practices with younger children. So there is something for everyone if you stick with it and listen throughout. I'm sure there's lots and lots of takeouts and some really great tips at the end, just really practical activities that you can do with your class tomorrow. Lots and lots in this episode. Here's what Shivetta had to say. Hi Shivetta, welcome to Comic Boom.
Hi Lucy, excited to be here.
Thank you so much for coming on to the programme. I'm a massive fan of your book. I wanted to start the conversation just by finding out a little bit more about you personally and how you came to be involved in comics and how that journey happened for you.
Yeah, I didn't read comics as a young reader, just from lack of exposure, I think. Didn't come to comics really as a reader or a teacher until I used it in the classroom when I taught high school English literature in the US in New York City public schools. And at that time, I just, you know, would see these young readers in front of me, some who were already engaged in reading and others who weren't, and just really wanted to open up the possibilities of all types of texts that I could bring into the classroom and help them develop like critical capacity for engaging with the media they already consumed. And it was a time when graphic novels were becoming more quote unquote canonized and more scholarly attention given to them. So I didn't have to sort of battle too much resistance from school boards or administration. You know, I started with some of the most sanctioned, accepted literary, you know, graphic novels to bring into the classroom. So that was really my introduction. Was I was new to it, as a lot of my students were, new to teaching it, new to critically examining it as a cultural artifact, and new to just reading it for pleasure as well.
What were some of your first texts that you taught from? And what were the kind of the stepping stones? How did that progress for you? Quite often, I don't know if it's the same in America, but in the UK, you get one text that you're going to teach, you get very familiar with it, and then you kind of keep doing that year after year. Or were you able to kind of break out of that initial range that you had and add in others later on?
Yes, I started with Persepolis from Marjane Satrapi and Mouse from Art Spiegelman. So I think those, at least back then, 20 years ago, were the graphic novels that would be brought into classrooms.
I mean, I think probably they'll be the most common still now.
Yes,
I thought that would have changed much.
Yeah. And so those fit really well, because at the time I was teaching a world literature class, and part of the syllabus required a unit on memoir. And so Satrapi's Persepolis was a perfect fit for both those reasons. And it was at the time, I think, around when the movie version was coming out. So it was on people's radar, and I knew my students would have some passing familiarity with it. So for all those reasons, I started with those, but very quickly I moved on to realizing, in trying to plan my curriculum, how much more was out there, and really enlisting my students to do some of that research and discovery and investigation, finding more graphic novels and comics of all kinds. And at the time, we weren't that familiar with web comics, but over time, that became a big source for my students to find additional, like lots of examples that weren't already kind of accepted and brought into the canon and lauded and full of accolades and just established and on publishers' lists and all of that. They were finding newer works, and you know, I kind of taught them to look for things that were surprising in any way in terms of what we observed in Persepolis or Mouse or some of the ones that they had studied in print, like looking at, well, what are some patterns in the ways that they are telling these stories and in terms of techniques and structure and design and craft, and then giving them invitation to find something that looks different from that or disrupts that or experiments with what you already know. And so that once the world of webcomics became really accessible to anyone with an internet connection, I sort of leveraged that and enlisted my students in discovering more works that we could engage with.
What did you notice was the impact on the young people that you were teaching? You're quite new to the form yourself, but it made you think, oh, there's actually something here. This is really interesting. This is something I can go on to develop.
Oh, well, we'll be talking all hour about that question. Well, one of the main things that stuck with me from the very first time I taught Persepolis was how, well, students were taking notes in like an active reading journal and looking at things like craft and structure and some of the design elements and how they contributed to theme and tone, you know, the same kinds of close reading they would do with a prose text. And I was surprised to see when I was collecting their journals and reading through them that they were resketching some of the panels, like roughly, you know, and if you're familiar with Persepolis, then it's not drawn with great, you know, artistic detail.
Yes, quite simplistic.
And yeah. So they were able to kind of resketch it in their notes. And then alongside that, they were crafting their own panels that were telling a similar kind of story from their own experiences. So like I had one student who took a panel from Persepolis where she's drawn from this bird's eye perspective, and she's walking down a road in the center of the road, and it's a tree lined street, and the trees are colored in with dark, you know, this is all in black and white, and the trees are black and they all look the same, just, you know, like how a 5-year-old might draw a tree, like a big poofy cloud. And they go off into the distance, exiting to the corner of the panel, decreasing in size. And it almost looks like she's walking through a funhouse mirror, you know, these replicated trees, this pattern. And in class, when we were talking about this panel, we made observations like what was happening in the story was that it was a big turning point. It was during the revolution when a lot of their family, friends, and acquaintances left and went to Europe, and they decided to stay because Margie was in this great school that they wanted her to continue to have access to. One of the students who chose this panel to redraw with himself in it, instead of the trees and the street in Iran, he drew our school building, which was a 6-story whole city block, really imposing kind of historical building. And the school had 6,000 students in it. And he had just moved there from a different high school. And he kind of really related to Margie's experience in that panel where he felt alone and isolated and intimidated. And he drew the building in that same style with the windows sort of replicating and the bird's eye perspective. And you see him down at the bottom in the front of the door. And so this, seeing this in my students' journals made me realize instantly that they found a way to tell their own stories. And that wasn't something that I would see that often in their notes, their close reading notes for prose text. And then as I started to really explore that idea of storytelling through the graphic form, through visual text, I just would see more and more of that. Like the types of stories students were choosing to tell were ones that you could tell didn't have closure for them or were experiences they were processing or learning. They didn't have language really to describe. So it seemed very clear that like these were stories they weren't telling in prose, and they really needed another tool or new tools, different tools. And that the visual medium, the blend of words and pictures, seemed like a promising thing to explore for them, you know, without me having to tell them like, today we're going to explore how to probe our difficult experiences using visual text. But yeah, it was something that they discovered.
That's really, really interesting. It sounds like they were already quite confident and had a lot of exposure to the form of graphic novels. I'm just wondering how prevalent the use of comics and graphic novels is. There wasn't any kind of debate around including them in the curriculum, which sounds like this might be a slightly different situation in America compared to the UK, because sometimes there still is a bit of debate going around. Is that just your school specifically, or is it a bit of a mixed picture?
Yeah, I think that was just my individual experience at that one point in time. I think similarly to the UK, it's hit or miss here in the US. And there are some districts maybe are seeing this in the news, just a lot of book banning happening right now. And Florida, for example, has very extreme laws and measures being proposed and passed with severe limited access to books of all kinds, so, and content of all kinds. So it's definitely still a challenge. And I work at the state level here in Oregon as an education leader. And I know just from that perch where I sit, I'm constantly in meetings or work sessions or looking at legislative policy or literacy framework. And I'm sort of that voice who's always like, well, let's talk about multimodal composition, or let's talk about multimodal assessment, or how can bring visual literacy into this conversation. Yeah. So I am very active in continuing to advocate for that. But of course, there are a lot of organizations as well in the US that are dedicated to doing that kind of advocacy as well. Like I'm part of a nonprofit. I'm on the board of a nonprofit called Reading with Pictures that maybe your listeners might be interested in checking out online. We've got a ton of resources and research, and we put on an annual conference for teachers as well. And they do tremendous work for advocacy. So, you know, I could answer that question in two different ways. You know, from the perspective of someone like me who's really immersed in those communities, it may feel like, yes, we've made a lot of progress and this is so widespread and people are so interested in learning this. Or I could say it from like my professional day job where I sit, you know, in state bureaucracy and in education administration, and see like, well, actually, this is not something people are talking about.
Just as you were talking there, I was just thinking, a penny dropped this side. Suddenly a thought just fell into place, which is that, yeah, it absolutely does need to be addressed at all levels. It is about what happens at the government level, at the school leadership level, and individual classroom practice and assessment. All of those things do shape, you know, what goes on in classrooms. And so, yeah, it can't just be one person's crusade, can it? It's got to be lots of different organizations and people promoting it and championing it, I guess.
Yeah, and I really see visual text as part of a systemic solution to a lot of inequities and challenges in schooling. And not so much as just like let's bring this fun text into the classroom to engage our young students. Like, sure, there's value in that, but I see a much bigger potential here, that it really is part of a systemic solution to all sorts of inequities and motivation challenges and access, and also just rigor and creating critical thinkers and consumers, you know, engaged citizens, people engaged, just not even citizen-wise, but just in their own lives and the things that they're viewing and walking around and experiencing and consuming.
Yeah, I think that's really, really interesting. That's definitely food for thought. And your book, Hacking Graphic Novels, you mentioned critical thinking, and your book focuses on higher level thinking, which I think might link to what you've just been saying there. So I'm interested if you could unpack a little bit what you mean by higher level thinking and why you think kind of graphic novels, comics are so suited as a kind of vehicle to promote that.
For that book, I wanted to move the conversation away from, like I was saying before, just pure engagement. You know, bring these texts in. They've got pictures. Like, kids who don't like reading words will like this. You know, this is how we'll bridge them towards, you know, real reading or complex reading or more serious reading or whatever that is. And from my experience visiting classrooms across the country, I was an instructional coach and literacy specialist and would travel across the country. And I would just see that there were so many missed opportunities, because if you frame it that way about just pure engagement and access and bridging to real reading, then you're not going to have students really engage with visual text the way that they actually demand. You know, they demand a cognitively rigorous engagement to even really be read. And so the students are just missing. They're just missing. You're robbing them of this high value experience of critically engaging with visual text with intention and care and insight. And so I think, you know, graphic novels lend themselves perfectly to that higher level thinking, because the notion of multimodal reading itself is a higher level concept. Like, it's something I have to introduce into spaces where I'm speaking with high level educators, you know, who have been in this for decades, or who've, you know, been administrator of the year, teachers of the year. You know, this is still just the fact that that idea of multimodal reading is still a new, strange concept to me makes it a higher level concept. The fact that there's so much resistance and avoidance because it's not conventional or known or understood by nature, that makes it interesting, you know, boundary pushing, exciting, scary. And to me, that's what higher level thinking is. It takes you into those realms and away from familiarity and convention. And so because you're forcing yourself out of a comfort zone to even think of engaging with something unconventionally rigorous with rigor, like that concept alone makes it a very special abstract area to mine and explore, where the map hasn't been laid out for you. And so when you bring that into the classroom, immediately you have students engaging with philosophical questions about why certain storytelling forms are more, you know, respected with a capital R, institutionalized, canonized, versus why some are chronically banned and censored or just relegated to pop culture. Oh, this is for fun. This is reading for fun. And this is real reading. And so you're able to now engage with those questions with students, those higher order thinking questions that don't have one answer or even an answer, but they're worth talking about. And then moving on from there, just in terms of the content of the text, you know, they're suited for higher level thinking because of, in the most simplest way, their abstract nature. So like we talked about with Persepolis, you know, it's not photorealistically drawn, and many graphic novels aren't, though some are. But that abstracted drawing, those iconic visuals that are really stripped of a lot of details, are leaving some ambiguity for the reader to fill in and to make meaning from the clues that are sort of given there. And this is a higher level of meaning making, you know, is required with that level of abstraction. And so, you know, when we're looking at exploring something in depth, then the less that's actually scripted out for you in what you're seeing and what you're reading, the more cognitive load you have to carry as that reader, then that's where the higher level thinking happens.
There's something there, I think, around when selecting a text that's appropriate to use, or you're going to be able to get the most out of in the classroom setting. There's something around quality there as well, like how, or I don't know if quality is the right word, but complexity, maybe around choosing a text where there is enough space for interpretation? And have you got any advice on where educators could start with making sure that perhaps they're not, you know, as you weren't at the start, they're not avid readers of graphic novels themselves at the moment, but they want to start exploring that in their classroom? Where can they start to kind of get a feel for what would be a good quality text that will get some interesting exploration out of in a classroom?
That's a great question, Lucy. It's a big one, and I want to be really careful when I give any advice out to your listeners with that.
Yeah.
a simple answer would be, you know, kind of to, sure, why not? Do what I did. You know, I picked a widely accessible, well-known, well-resourced graphic novel. There was almost a level of guarantee there. You know, like I may not have a lot of resistance with this. Like, people understand that, you know, this has won awards and it's on lists, and you know, you can easily order it, a class set of it, you know, for your school, because that's done so often and there's tons of curriculum and resources available. Like that's always an easy place to start. And there's nothing wrong with that at all. And you could simply do what I ended up doing, which is then enlisting students into finding other work that's contemporary. And in my book, I give a lot of great resources for how to find that, crossing all demographics and cultures and text type as well. But something I will say too, that I want to make sure is clear, is that any text is really rich, right? And worthy of close study, complex or sufficiently abstract or all of those criteria. But if it isn't, it's still very valuable in terms of studying as a cultural artifact, you know, so like, what does this reveal? Who's reading this and how is it perceived and what's being missed? And if we look at it from this context, what might it be commenting on, or how is this being marketed and what kinds of lists do we see it on? Where is it in the library? Why is it shelved that way? You know, like there's just so many ways that we really should be engaging with the visual text that aren't necessarily, you know, capital A art. But then, you know, also if you do want to really have a text that has a lot of leverage and you can use it in a lot of different ways in the classroom, I do have some criteria to suggest. So I like to think about not just with visual text, like words and pictures or sequential art, but also visuals of any kind. I like to think about the amount of detail. Is it very intricate and complex versus spare? But again, neither one means it's more rich, you know,
there's like a hierarchy like, there. Yeah.
Yeah. Like with Persepolis, like the very spare drawings can be quite rich as well. But to at least consider that, look at those differences, and then the amount of ambiguity. So, you know, there might be some and there might be a lot. And if it's drawn very photorealistically in each panel and you go from one frame to the next and there hasn't been a significant gap in time or space or perspective, it's really just like one drinking from a cup in one panel and then the cup is placed down on the table in the next. Like there aren't significant gaps and transitions that are taking you to different perspectives and time periods and locations, then it's less ambiguous. Or maybe if the perspectives aren't drawn from various angles or there isn't a lot of light and shadow being played with, like it may be less ambiguous. And again, neither one means more rich or not, or more quality or not, you know, but those are just elements to consider in terms of student engagement and readiness to interrogate and consider all of those different elements. And then, of course, issues of familiarity. So like with Persepolis, where I was teaching in New York City school, I had Muslim students and students who wore veils. And that wasn't an obscure concept for the students walking around in the halls that are living in New York City at the time. So versus if you teach it in a different environment, that might be very obscure or evocative or evoke or activate some sorts of preconceived notions about those images and that content. And then the idea of content connection. So like, is this visual text or the visual, does it give you leverageable content? Like, is it multidisciplinary? Does it connect to multiple topics across content areas? Which I find, like, if you're only going to teach one visual text, that might be something to prioritize. Is it something that students can now connect to what they're learning across the school day, which, you know, should really always be the goal. Like individual subject area teachers like we have here may not very often do they collaborate, you know, in lesson design and curriculum planning, which is a huge loss. So, you know, the power within your sphere of change, you know, within your own capacity in the text that you choose, can you provide opportunities for students to make those connections across content areas or challenge what they are learning about a historical event or a scientific phenomena like climate change? Or does this allow for unique insights and perspectives on something they're already learning and acquiring vocabulary around that can round out sort of the traditional sources and texts they're already learning from?
Do you feel like there's a bit of a shift in mindset that teachers need to go through? Because with the more modern books or with graphic texts, there's not necessarily that kind of clear-cut right answer of how things should be interpreted.
I think maybe there's a little more element of ambiguity with the words and pictures combined than there is, say, when you're reading a prose novel. It's still, this is where how I try to make progress with school districts using graphic novels. It's in this U.S. where a lot of our curriculum state by state is modeled after the what we call the Common Core standards. Mm-hmm. And we use for teaching literary skills, the Common Core language arts standards. And so I really try to use language from those standards around close reading and critical reading to show like, well, you would still be doing those same skills to the mm-hmm. same standard in a visual text, which is all about your interpretations are supported by logical reasoning and evidence from the text. Like there, it's not, you know, an opportunity to just say like, well, I think this author is making this point. And it's like, okay, well, let's explore that. You know, how do you know that? What did you read that supports that claim? What evidence can you cite and unpack it for us, you know, make the connections. And they're usually doing that in writing and speaking. And with visual text, it's simply, you know, oh, okay, tell me, well, what do you see that makes you say that? You know, you can't just say like, oh, well, this character is angry and she hates wearing the veil. Okay, that's an interesting claim. I wonder more about that. What do you see that makes you say that? Oh, we'll see here, like her mouth is drawn upside down, like she's frowning. And the only other detail in the panel is that she's wearing a veil. So it must be because of that. Oh, okay. Well, what else, if we look again, what else can we find? Do we see any details that might contradict that? You know, so it's like, yeah. It's really the same skills you're doing in.
Yeah, still about evidence, reasoning.
Exactly.
You advise in your book not to, from the outset, teach the vocabulary of comics, but to instead sort of allow students to explore and see what they can find themselves independently from that knowledge of the kind of technical terms of the panels and so on. What was the thinking behind that? What led you to that kind of conclusion that was the best practice?
Yes. Well, I'm a curriculum designer as well, an instructional designer. And so I am always engaging with these questions when I design lessons, that the idea of when is it appropriate to have sort of a direct instruction, explicit instruction approach here, and when is it appropriate to have it be more student-centered or constructivist or, you know, discovery-led. Like there's all different terms, but you see the binary, at least that's kind of a big binary here in the U.S. in terms of like direct instruction versus student-centered. And
yeah,
there's synonyms for either side. But I think most educators realize you want both. You know, you're incorporating both. And the questions we need to ask when we're designing is, you know, is it better suited in this moment for direct explicit instruction or for a student-centered approach? And what helps me make those decisions is really asking, well, at what point do I need students to be doing the thinking, the interesting thinking? When do I need students carrying the cognitive load versus me explaining that or the teacher sort of guiding them through and modeling and demonstrating that? And so I ask as well, you know, well, what is lost? What would be lost if the direct instruction approach would be taken here? And does that outweigh the benefits of using the direct instruction approach in this circumstance? So I, you know, in that case, some of the research on, you know, when you would use explicit instruction and really walk students through the content or give them the information would be like, would it really be taxing their working memory if they had to sort of discover that all on their own in order to really get to the interesting part of testing it and experimenting with it and manipulating it and applying it in different hands-on experiences? You know, so sometimes it makes more sense to like, well, it would be a tax on their working memory for them to do all of that. It would be really inefficient, and they never would really get to the point where they'd be working with that information in an interesting way. Then it would make sense, you know, to front load that with direct instruction and explicit instruction and really give them that content so then they could get to the interesting part. But in this case that you bring up with, you know, showing them, this is how you would read a graphic novel. Like, look over here. This is called a bleed. When the image goes beyond the frame, it's bleeding out of the border. Or look over here. You know, this is called emanata. It shows emotions without words or squiggly lines and whatnot. It would be like direct instruction. This is how you read a graphic novel. And so in that sense, I really had to consider, well, like, what is gained by doing that? And then what is lost? And is there a reason to do that, because it would be too much of a tax on students' working memories to not have that vocabulary front loaded and engage directly with the visual text themselves? And my answer was no, that wouldn't be too much to ask, you know, that students are born essentially with the capacity to look, and we can leverage our sighted children. And we can leverage that inherent ability, that innate ability, and that urge to want to see things for themselves and point to things and describe them and list them and observe them and then make meaning from them by sort of telling a narrative about what's happening in this panel, in this picture. And so I also, you know, found that just through hands-on experience in the classroom, that when I did give myself, when I did give them the terms ahead of time and said, like, well, here's how you read it. You go from left to right and then down in a diagonal. You do a Z across the page. And no, the vocabulary we're going to use is like, this is a splash page because you see how the blah, blah, blah. And I just found that it created really rigid readers of visual text that are often not following, you know, a set of standards and rules. That to me, the most engaging visual texts are the ones that are experimenting with the idea of a splash page or experimenting with the idea of emanata or any of those tools. And it may not look the way that you taught it to them in the first place. And so then if you're telling students very early on, this is what a bleed is, this is what a splash is, here's an example, it creates this kind of like reliance on that definition and an avoidance to really think outside of that and to spot examples of when that's being challenged and played with in interesting ways. And it kind of just seemed to turn their brains off to really doing a lot of the looking and observing themselves. And what I found was when I have them first just look at pictures and follow some of these established visual thinking strategies, like naming and listing what they see and answering, you know, what's going on in this picture and how do you know, what do you see that makes you say that, you know, using those kinds of visual cues to help students really look closely and engage with what they're seeing, they always pull out way more from the page in terms of craft and structure and design tools and devices than what would ever be provided in a cheat sheet, so to speak, like in that direct instruction. You can't possibly directly instruct all that information. And if you do, well, then you're doing the thinking. You know, that's an example where like you're doing interesting thinking. You're taking that away from students.
And do you think that has a knock-on effect in terms of think about that relationship between reading and writing, consuming and creating? I would imagine that they would have a positive effect on their willingness to experiment when they're creating their own visual texts as well, because they're not thinking of it as a kind of, this is what makes us successful. Like, I've got this success criteria in my head of what I need to include in my own visual text. They're rather just able to maybe think more instinctively about what they're doing.
Yes, I think maybe some listeners are hearing this and thinking, well, actually, that sounds like it would be a lot harder for students to actually create visual text themselves, because there isn't a guide in terms of starting with like, okay, include four panels and one splash and one bleed and, yeah. you know, this sort of checklist that often we do with writing, you know, with the traditional essays. But I think so all of that, you know, we don't want to overwhelm students with possibilities. For sure, and cripple them in terms of like getting started on their own and make committing to some choices. I think if we're providing opportunities to do that throughout the reading process, you know, in small bursts, like a warm up for the day, like let's look at this image, you know, it may not be connected to the content or to the book you're reading, but it's an image, you know, and it's worth engaging with. And we just have 5 minutes of practice. What's going on in this picture? You know, what do you see that makes you say that? And then, you know, maybe asking like for a 5 minute homework assignment or something, like out in your community or in your home environment or your sports practice or wherever you go outside of school, like what is something that you haven't looked at, you know, very closely, but you see it every day or you walk by it every day. It could be a billboard type image, or it could simply be an object you pass by and, you know, look at it for 5 minutes and just make a list, you know, on your notepad or in your phone, and highlight the most surprising detail you actually discovered when you just took the time to look at that and with care and attention. And bring that to class tomorrow, you know, just share the most interesting highlight. So I think when we're doing small bursts of that kind of critical engagement, students are developing a repertoire of not just language, but of strategies. And then even when you're crafting the stories with them, you know, you're helping them with some questions and guidance around, well, what is the effect you're trying to get at here? What do you want your readers to feel? What do you want them to wonder? And not always to know, right? Because like Will Eisner said, you have to give up some element of control when you're writing sequential art, because you can't control, you know, how images are going to be read. Like there really isn't a universal visual language the way that kind of with like an English word, you know, we see a word and it, you know, has phonemes and it means a certain thing. The sounds mean when they're together, they mean this word, and that word has a certain meaning. Of course, it can change in some context, but like with visuals, there's a little bit more of a lack of control around how the images and their juxtapositions are going to be interpreted. So having students think through like, well, what do you want readers to wonder or experience in this page? And what are some ways you've experienced that in visuals? What are some of those techniques that stand out to you? Well, you don't remember? Well, let's go back. Let's go back to our journals. Let's go back to some of our discussions, some of, you know, the notes that are on our chart papers in the room, or whatever you've been doing to document.
And so how do the journals work? They have like a book that they can just always be making notes quite freely in, and they kind of record their responses.
Yes. That's how I traditionally do it, is just lined notebooks. And so nothing special, you know, no special tools required, however students are engaging with their prose text, like how are they doing their close reading for any book, any text that they're studying, I would just use the same system, you know, no need to reinvent anything. These days, you know, there's a lot of digital note-taking, which I think can really be leveraged for visual text as well, because I mean, maybe they can take a screenshot of, if they're reading like an ebook or PDF version of the book, they can take a screenshot of a panel, plop it into their note app or you know, whatever they're doing, and they can start tweaking it digitally. They can erase, you know, features of it. They can move pieces of it.
I feel like I want to do this. This is great.
Yeah.
Start my own reading journal.
You create comics too, don't you? So
yeah, I do, in a very amateur way. But I'm trying to, something I'm trying to learn and get better at and explore for sure. I'm just conscious we've been talking a lot about older students, but in your book you give examples that you've obviously researched and spoken to practitioners right from the early years, kindergarten, right the way through. How have you seen the approach to visual text being used throughout the kind of years. Obviously, you're not going to be able to share all of your knowledge, but a couple of examples of where you've seen really effective practice in younger year groups would be really useful for listeners, I think.
Yes, yeah, some of the same questions that I've brought up with the older students would be perfect for younger students. So the texts would be more appropriate, you know, for their age level. But the questions and the process, I think, would still be similar in terms of what's going on in this picture, you know. And I know the Visual Thinking Strategies Group, started by the Museum of Modern Art Education Specialists in New York, and has grown into this huge organization and curriculum that's used probably across the world, but definitely in the US, which is, you know, they settled on this question through research, you know, what's going on in this picture? Because instinctually, when we do look at images, we use a narrative structure to make meaning of it. Mm-hmm. We're telling a story to ourselves. And that was sort of the best landed on in terms of like an opener question that was accessible to all, was simply, what's going on in this picture? And then following that up, well, what do you see that makes you say that? And now they start pulling out detail and really making inferences or supporting claims and doing all of those skills that, at least here in the US, even in the early grades, you know, K-1, 2, they are part of our standards, you know, is teaching them that ability. And especially since kids may not actually be reading, decoding fluently and making meaning from what they decode in those ages, well, of course we should be using sequential art. Of course we should be using visual storytelling to help them really practice those skills of skilled readers. Once they can make meaning from the words themselves, they can still be practicing all of those other reading skills and standards that we strive for by doing that with leveraging their innate ability to see and their interest in looking for themselves. Like they want to see themselves. You know, we're very compelled to want to look at an image more than we are to want to read something. So that's not just true of young children, obviously. So we're teaching our students how to approach anything unfamiliar or complex or foreign or that maybe doesn't have the same language you have. And, you know, we can start teaching that engagement before children can even read words. And these visual texts have a built-in kind of differentiated instruction capacity, because students who can't read the words or who are multilingual or learning English as a second or third language, they don't have that shared language, but what they do have is visual language, you know, that they can look and see and engage in discussion about what's going on and how do they know that.
I mean, I've just remembered as you were talking that was something when I first started teaching, I was the art leader, and I would do for the whole school like a once a month an artwork of the month, and every class, all the different ages, would look at the same thing in their classroom and just have like a 10 to 15 minute chat about their kind of response to it in a very similar way. And I'd completely forgotten that until you started talking through. And yeah, it was so great for just discussion, you know, just oracy, listening, all of those skills just really. And they come in, they cross over with so many other areas of the curriculum. They're just really key skills. Yeah, that was cool. I remember one artwork, this is a complete digression that I will edit out, but I did one of the pieces of art was this Ron Muick sculpture, which is like, it was a baby sort of swaddled in brown paper and tied with string. You can see his little head poking out. And to me, that was about a kind of special delivery. It was like a little parcel. And I had very positive connotations with that. And then one of the other teachers was very, very upset about it and thought it was horrible. And that the baby was like, I don't know, tied up against its will and wrapped in paper. So yeah, that was a bit of a learning curve for me. I had to maybe think through how other people might interpret things before I shared. She was really upset and cross about it.
Oh, that's funny. Yeah, I mean, yeah, you, like Will Eisner says, you don't have there's an element of control you're giving up, and it can be very unpredictable how we'll make meaning from visual language.
Yeah, for sure. Thank you so much. When I read your book, I got so excited, because I felt like this is what we need in the world. I feel like we're partway on the journey in the UK anyway, thinking about comics and graphic novels being a benefit for reading for pleasure. But then that almost comes with this kind of sort of inference to it that it's just purely just about engagement, and there isn't an intellectual element to reading. And yeah, like you said earlier, right at the start, that there's this sort of subtext of it's something to get children hooked onto reading, but then you need to move them off of it as soon as they're actually got going. So yeah, it was a real breath of fresh air to find something that was really speaking to me, to the sort of thoughts that I have been having. And yeah, it was just such a valuable resource. So thank you.
Oh, that's great. I'm glad it's useful.
It really is. I wondered, just you've spoken about quite a lot of things, if you could pick out a couple of key takeaways that you might want to leave educators listening, just something to think about that we can kind of summarize a couple of points at the end of the episode.
Sure. I would say something I kept coming back to was this one question: what's going on in this picture? You know, used as an acronym, WGOITP. But that alone, I mean, that's your lesson plan tomorrow. I mean, that have students bring something in and we go around the room and we might only get through five of them, but it's just a ready to go, high leverage, worthwhile, interdisciplinary, high level thinking question that you can use with, you know, very low maintenance. And it helps students activate that ability already to look and to want to look for themselves and to look again and to use that inclination for narrative structure to describe what you see is happening. And then inevitably, I guarantee you will see students questioning what they originally thought they saw or what they originally thought was there. And they're going to walk away from that experience, whether it's 5 minutes or the whole half hour, with more appreciation and wonder about what they're looking at than they started with. And then, you know, maybe another extension or similar thing from that is, whatever you're teaching, whatever age, you know, or content area, a simple ask — this would be a great way to do a formative assessment to determine sort of how students are progressing with the content or the skills — is, it's called line, color, symbol. You know, ask them to draw a line or choose a color or create any kind of symbol that represents what they understand about X, you know. So it might be, oh, we've been learning about photosynthesis, you know, I'd like you to just choose a color, draw a line, or make a mark on your paper, create a little symbol that represents what you now understand about how photosynthesis works. And just the rich variety in what students come up with, and the value is really in how they explain their choice, will give you a lot of insight into how,
yeah,
they're,
so interesting,
how they're thinking about the content. And then again, both of these, what's going on in this picture and line, color, symbol, keep in mind that they are collaborative. So students, this isn't like a teacher to student one-to-one exchange. Students are learning a lot from how their peers are answering and engaging with these tasks and questions. And they're getting exposure to multiple ways of thinking and seeing and knowing. Students are using their own assets and their own funds of knowledge and culture and language and backgrounds to interpret. And so much more value there in terms of it, you know. You really want to leverage the fact that you're in a classroom, you have 30 kids in front of you, you know, well, how can we make that? How can I spend time in the classroom where I'm really leveraging the fact that I have 30 minds and 30 perspectives and 30 home experiences and 30 cultures, like all in this one space? No, let me do something that's going to leverage that.
Yeah, so exciting when you think of it that way. Although sometimes the reality of having 30 minds in front of you can feel a little bit different in the moment.
Yes, I'm sure I'm getting some eye rolls out there in the audience. Listeners, like, yes, I admit I have left the classroom in recent years, but I do remember that I had 36 kids in each class and 5 classes a day and, you know, 150 notebooks to look through. And so I definitely empathize with that.
The final element that we have on the podcast is, if we were to add one comic or book, could be an academic text, could be a graphic novel, that you recommend that we should add to our to-be-read piles tomorrow, what would you recommend us to?
Yes, I always struggle with that question, but I have landed on something. There is a book, I think it's from 2013, by Philip Yenoween. I may be mispronouncing the name, but he's one of the founders of this approach, visual thinking strategies, VTS. So you can certainly buy the book. I find it a really rewarding read. I mean, even just reading the first 5 pages that are available for free on Amazon, it was going to get a lot of, you'll see a lot of what I said today kind of echoed in there. But in terms of strategies for any grade level, starting very young, I think he also wrote a version of it for preschool, but just those strategies, like what's going on in this picture, but a lot more than just that, and ways to make sure that as a facilitator of those kinds of discussions of visual texts and noticing and observing, that you're doing that in an equity-based way. There's all sorts of considerations to think through. So what a rewarding read and resource. But I also want to just say, like, yes, for sure, buy the book and support the authors, but their website, Visual Thinking Strategies, has a journal that is accessible for free on their website. And so you can sometimes that's going to the website and reading what's there on blogs is often your best.
Yeah, and nice and bite-sized as well. Yeah.
Yeah, and it's just so current. I feel like I really need to get on blogging because there's so many things in my book that I would write differently now, and it's too late. It's out there. It's published. So check out the Visual Thinking Strategies website, and they also have an Instagram where they post images and students can join live into a conversation across the world with students in classes all over answering what's going on in this picture. So their Instagram is also a great resource.
That is really, really useful. Thank you. That sounds like a fantastic resource. I'm definitely going to be checking that out. I feel like this is one of those times where I'm going down a wormhole. I'm going to go down. I'm just going to be obsessed by finding out as much as I can about this for the next who knows how long, because it's just absolutely fascinating. And I just think it's so powerful. So thank you for sharing that. And thank you for coming on the podcast. It's been brilliant to talk to you.
It's been great to talk to you, Lucy. I'm so happy to have been here. I hope this was interesting for your listeners, and maybe I can come back another time. And I'm really looking forward to the other guests you have planned.
Yeah, thank you. There's still so much more to talk about. After I've gone down my visual thinking wormhole, you can come back.
Oh, yes. Let's talk about that together. You know, you can even sign up to be a facilitator for them for visual thinking strategies. I think they have all sorts of coaching, and yeah, it's definitely a wormhole, but have fun. Have fun going down there.
There we have it. So much to think about from that episode. I really enjoyed talking to Shveta. She has got such a wide range of knowledge on the subject and has really walked the walk in terms of teaching with comics in the classroom. So there's lots to learn, I found. I had a really good look through those websites. I have been going down the wormhole of visual literacy in all its forms, and really, really interesting. That website in particular, there's a link to it in the show notes, Visual Thinking Strategies. There's lots of useful content on there, and the journal is fabulous, and a lot of different case studies and different examples from different age groups, so you can really dig into the kind of practicality of different activities and exercises with some background and some kind of case studies as to how they've been used successfully, which is always really useful if you're going to start something new in your practice. If you click through to the Padlet from the show, which you'll find in the show notes, you'll find all of the links for this episode. In fact, you'll find all of the links for the whole of this series in one easy to access place, so do check that out. What have I been doing? I've now started my drawing graphic narratives course at the Royal Drawing School, and I'm really enjoying it. It's very exposing, definitely, to be creating things. So within the one sort of 3-hour session, there's a stimulus, there's a discussion, and then you're there showing what you've done to the class immediately for critique, which usually I'd want to sit on things for a while before I let anyone see them, decide whether I like them or not before I let anyone else decide. But there isn't time for that in this, and that's a real learning curve, but it's been a really, really useful experience so far. And I've really enjoyed, in the kind of lecture part, finding some more comic artists whose work I wasn't aware of. And we looked at one this week, a comic called Lavender by Sarah Usherhi, and I've put her website into the show notes. She is a London-based illustrator and comics creator, and her drawing style is very delicate and beautiful, very stunningly paced stories. I really enjoyed looking at her work, and will definitely be seeking out more of that in the future. So check that one out as well if you're looking for something new to read. That is it for today from Comic Boom. Thank you so much for listening. Sorry about last week. I had a bit of a busy week and couldn't quite get this episode out in time, but we're back. I'm not stressing about it. It's all fine. Just go with the flow. So thank you so much for picking back up with me and listening to this episode. Do like, share with your networks and subscribe on your platform so that you do not miss an episode. And if there isn't one, you'll know it's my fault, not yours. but thanks very much. You've been listening to Comic Boom, which is presented by and produced by me, Lucy Starbuck-Bradley. Thanks for listening.